Welcome to the Break the Mold Parking Podcast with myself, Ryan Jackson.
And me, Alistair Finlayson.
And in each episode, we'll be discussing the very latest in parking news and industry insights.
As well as cutting-edge business and thought leadership topics.
You're listening to Break the Mold Podcast Show, and today we have a very special guest indeed. Our guest today, he holds a major voice in the parking and transporting sector. He's previously held the role of Director General of Roads, Traffic and Local Group at the Department for Transport. And in 2015, he took the position as the new Director of the RAC Foundation. So today, we would like to welcome to the show Mr. Steve Gooding, who's the Director of the RAC Foundation. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
No problem at all. So, Steve, for those that may not be aware of what the RAC Foundation represents, could you just give us a bit more information on that, please? A bit
sure.
of a background.
Absolutely. The RAC Foundation, just to start with what it isn't, we're not the breakdown boys. We don't have any orange vans. If your car breaks down, don't ring me because I won't be any help
so
at all.
So I could delete your number in that sense.
Delete that number. And we're not the members club with the very fancy clubhouse on Pall Mall. Mm-hmm. But we were set up by the members club back over 20 years ago now, set up as an independent think tank. So we're a charity. Mm-hmm. We had a big donation from the club to set us going. And basically, our mission is to generate and disseminate research relating to motoring in all its many aspects.
Okay, amazing. And so with your main priority being one of the main priorities being the protection of motorists. So do you feel enough is being done to educate motorists on parking or parking related issues?
Well, let's start with what the mission is beyond just commissioning research. Mm-hmm. The purpose of the foundation is really to remind everyone that alongside some of the downsides of motoring, emissions, safety and all those things that we don't like, mm-hmm. there are benefits to be had. So we need to have a balance. And that was the original concept of setting the foundation up back in the early 1990s. I think over the years, we've looked at particular areas. I've been there just over 4 years. Mm-hmm. One of the areas the foundation has looked at, which I don't think anyone else has, which I think comes to your question, mm-hmm. is the issue of parking. It's rather not thought about as part of the trip, strangely really,
yeah.
because you would think it was an integral part of how we get about and how we live our daily lives. But one thing I think is really quite strange, I think the layman would think quite strange, is that parking is not a policy issue for the Department for Transport. It's mm-hmm. actually looked after by the Ministry of Housing, mm-hmm. which is a bit strange.
It's pretty crazy, no?
So I think you're right. I think the question implies, are we aware enough about parking? Do we think about it enough? Perhaps another way of coming at it is, I don't really think about parking any more than I think about income tax. I just have to get on and do it. Mm-hmm. So do I want to learn about it? Do I want to understand more? Actually, there's plenty of other things that I'd like to spend my time on. And if I wasn't doing this job, I suspect I'd know a whole lot less about the parking world.
Mm-hmm. And so from a motorist viewpoint, because one of the things that we've discussed as an organisation is the fact that parking is something that's probably looked over at the first point of whereby motorists are receiving that driver education. Do you think more should be done in the first instance at a point where they're learning to drive to educate them on the rules around parking?
I think you're making a very good point there. Mm. This is going to surprise you and your listeners, but it's quite a while since I learned to drive.
And I don't believe that, Steve.
I don't remember my driving lessons terribly clearly now, although mm-hmm. clearly I was a natural and it all went very well. But if one thinks about it, we should really be teaching people not so much just how to master the technique of managing a vehicle, mm-hmm. but helping them do everything they need to do in order to get where they want to be. Mm-hmm. So if we were teaching someone how to use the railway, we'd teach them how to buy tickets, mm-hmm. we'd teach them how to get in and out the station, how to get on and off the train. If we're teaching people to drive, I think it's a good idea mm-hmm. that we would include in that some advice from the instructor, not just on how to parallel park on the street, but what the issues might be that you need to know about when you're going into other spaces.
Mm. And as someone that is a new driver, I only passed 4.5, 5 years ago. So I did the test quite recently, and I'm sure this would resonate with a lot of new, younger drivers. Obviously, the highway code is where a lot of sort of parking rules are laid out in terms of yellow lines, double yellow lines, etc. But how you pass the theory test these days are, from my experience anyway, and I'm sure there are a lot of people that would resonate with this, is you just download an app onto your smartphone and you just memorize the questions and the answers, and you're not actually learning the highway code. So then when it comes to your driving lessons, we spent all of 10 minutes practicing to park, and that was only because the driving instructor wanted to get a coffee at the local Burger King. And when it comes to the maneuvers, you've got the parallel park, which is, you know, something that people shy away from, you know. Whenever you speak to anyone and you say, what maneuver did you get on your test, and you say the parallel park, there's always that stunned silence of, oh, that didn't go too well. So parking is something that people do sort of tend to shy away from. And should there be a parking test as well as a driving test? Because, you know, you do see a lot of horrendous parking.
Well, I think when we think about the driving test specifically and what we're testing for, the competence that we're testing for, I think it's right that the Driver and Vehicle Standards Agency focuses on the areas that are most risky. So whilst I agree that there's certainly a case for your driving instructor spending perhaps more than 10 minutes, and frankly, if it's 10 minutes while they're out the car getting coffee, you're not going to learn much, but spending just a bit of time explaining that the highway code goes so far, but the highway code, astonishingly, is all about the highway. And I don't think it says a great deal, if anything at all, about off-street parking or private parking or what restrictions might apply or how places might be managed. So I think it's right in recent years, after you passed your test, so congratulations for that, after you passed your test, the test has been changed to make less of the slow speed technical manoeuvring and have more time spent at higher speeds, which is more dangerous, on busier roads out in traffic. So I think from the test perspective, it's good to go that way. But I think if you look at the overall picture, then perhaps a bit more advice, which might come from the driving instructor. It could come from organisations like yourselves or from the motoring organisations, so that when you pick up something like the Highway Code or you pick up one of the motoring magazines when you're starting to think about owning a car, that you might find something in there that's a bit more informative.
But it's quite an interesting point that you made in relation to the test focusing on things that are most dangerous. And I think this is where sort of parking does suffer and being overlooked, because bad parking is dangerous. If a car was parked in such a bad way, an ambulance or a fire engine couldn't get through. While it's not directly dangerous to the person or anyone near there, but the instance which has happened further on where the ambulance, fire engine, police car needs to get to, it's causing danger there because it's delaying emergency services getting from A to B. So it is something that I think does need a little bit more focus.
Well, it's certainly the case that part of learning to drive should include advice, a warning, if anything, that obstructing the carriageway is not a good idea for a whole bunch of reasons, including those that you mention. I don't think anyone's driving instructor should skip lightly past the idea that you don't stop on double yellow lines, you don't stop on single lines, you don't stop when you've got into a box junction, you only go in when you can get clear. There's a whole bunch of things that are about the use of the carriageway. I was more thinking beyond that, beyond it, to the point, for example, I've walked past two public car parks on my way to your office today, and there are issues about how you'd use those. If you've never used a pay and display machine, it might be quite unfamiliar. And the fact that different car parks have different mechanisms for taking
and
your money.
And tariffs as well.
Different tariffs. And whilst some of the aspects are common between the private parking world and the world of local authority controlled parking, they aren't necessarily the same, and they might be different and you might not realise it. So I do think perhaps we need to encourage people to educate themselves. But thinking about it, thinking about my son's learning to drive recently, I'm not sure where I'd send them, other than, of course, taking them out myself and saying, this is what you need to look out for, this is what you need to understand.
So it kind of leads me on to the next question. When you touched upon the you know, local authority parking, do you feel that potentially the private sector, because I know it's definitely our position, has taken a lot of the backlash and maybe used as a scapegoat for generally parking and negative parking experiences? It's our viewpoint that the industry itself has advanced quite considerably over the past few years, and the standards that are now set by the accrediting bodies ensure a quality of services delivered. And I think beyond that, of public parking. So if you used a great example is this the road which we're located on. So in relation to signage, I think there's probably one or two signs, maybe every 30 metres or so. And we know that would never be allowed from, you know, either the BPA or the IPC. So do you think in some respect, the local authority parking has now got to play catch up to ensure that it's adhering to the same level of standards as that of the private sector?
I think I'd have to start with sort of rolling back maybe 10 years. Mm-hmm. Because I think at that point, my predecessors, the RAC Foundation, were probably getting as many individual complaints and hassles from people complaining about local authority parking control as they were about private parking control. Mm-hmm. To be honest, these days, we rarely get anything. So something in the world of local authority parking management is going right. In terms of individuals feeling they've been hard done by or individuals having a complaint, I think that there is still a lot of interest in local authority parking, not least it's quite a money spinner for some local authorities. And we've seen the amount of income generated by parking, including penalty charges, going up. And all the time that local authority budgets are under stress, and we all know that local authority spending is squeezed by the need to cover social care and the like, it's a suspicion that they may be seeing parking and parking penalties as a nice way of earning a bit of revenue to do other things, which, of course, in law, they're required to spend any surplus on transport. And in law, they're not allowed to set the charges with a view to generating a surplus. It has to be for traffic purposes. So I think they're not exactly out of the woods, but they've come a long way. What we observe in the private parking world is not uniform. So let me just be clear about that. There are many companies that get on and manage their business very well. And the vast majority of people, I suspect, who park on private land today will do so perfectly happily. What we've observed in the foundation, and again, this began long before I joined, was the number of vehicle keeper releases from the DVLA going through the roof. And what I said many times, and I've said it to the trade associations too, I've said it to the ministry, I think this is management information. It's telling us something. Now, whether it's telling us that there's sharp practice, malpractice, whether it's telling us that it's just poor practice, I don't know, because I can't go and inspect every car park. What I can tell you is that based on the latest figures from the DVLA, we're on track to have something in the region of 8.5 million vehicle keeper releases. And that strikes us as a lot. And it strikes us that something in the mix is probably going wrong. Mm-hmm. And whether that's the trade associations not being quite as stringent as you say, or whether it's something else, well, we need to find out.
Is that a change in something going wrong, or is that just a change in technology and how enforcement takes place? You know, given that we're seeing an increase in ANPR, which obviously the public sector can't do, but the private sector can.
There's a bit of both going on here. So let's go back to the Protection of Freedoms Act and the desire of the new government in 2010 to come in and, as they put it, to see an end to cowboy wheel clamping. I don't know if you're both, I would say, probably far too young to remember this, but I recall.
Thank you for the compliment, Steve. I wish that was the case.
wheel clamping was a headline issue, and newspapers, the tabloid newspapers, were very excited about it. So wheel clamping had to go. At the point where wheel clamping went, it is not surprising that we saw more vehicle keeper requests, because after all, if you can't disable the vehicle driver is going to go away, and if you need to get in touch with them for some reason, that's a way of doing it. So I can see that it would go up, and I can see that with camera technology, as you say, you can use camera technology for managing private parking, that, again, if you need to contact the keeper of a vehicle because there's some reason you need to contact them, whether that's for a parking charge notice or other reasons, then the only way of doing that, probably, unless you've been able to stick a notice under the windscreen wiper, is to do that through a keeper request. But if we think about the technology for a moment, one of the things that concerns me, I guess, is the preponderance of pay and display over, say, other forms of parking, old-fashioned things at off-street car parks like barrier parking or using your mobile phone to pay for the time you've spent rather than having to guess how much time you're going to spend. And I think that's one of the problems people face. It's probably why the government decided it was very keen for local authorities to have a mandatory grace period after the end of a parking stay. So I think the technology might be one of the reasons we're seeing more keeper requests. But I do wonder, looking ahead, whether the technology is becoming cheaper and easier to use in a more intelligent way and in a way that would be more customer focused, even though it might not be as clear cut as the existing system.
So do you ever see a time whereby operators themselves will move away from an enforcement model?
Well, I would like to think so. I mean, I think that in a way, the very question illustrates the issue that ideally we'd be seeing the provision of parking. And we're talking here about parking where you are actually inviting me to come onto the land and park there. I'm not here talking about people who are taking a liberty and driving onto private land when they shouldn't. But if I've been invited on to your car park, I'd like to be treated as a customer. An example, much less to be encountered these days, but in the dark days a couple of years ago, I observed that if I went to my local supermarket, I went in, parked the car, go into the supermarket. If I dropped a bottle of mayonnaise and it shattered on the floor, they'd rush over and they'd say, "I'm sorry, let me clear that up." And then if I overstayed in the car park, they'd send me a threatening letter. And it just seemed slightly
counterproductive.
Odd
that
the supermarket wanted me to be there. They almost certainly, assuming I didn't drop loads of bottles, they want me to come back because they want me to spend my money there. So they should be welcoming me and they should be making the whole experience a lot easier. Now, I have to say, I've awarded my gold star of the previous decade to Sainsbury's because Sainsbury's remodeled their car parks to include a big enough space between the cars so you can open the car door, which I think is a big step forward. But also, as I drive into Sainsbury's, there's a very clear sign that I go past that shows me this is your vehicle registration and you need to be gone by this time. So there can be no doubt in my mind, I can see that the light flashes up, it's as clear as day.
So do you think retailers have to be the ones to take a bigger responsibility for their car park?
I think that any, whether it's a retailer, whatever the business is, the business to which the car park is attached should be paying very close attention to what's being done in their name. Because frankly, because of the job I do know who operates the car park. But most people would think, well, it's Sainsbury's or it's Tesco's or it's whoever, or it's the shopping centre. They don't think of it as being a separate company. And if they're not treated as they would like to be, as valued customers, then that's a damage to the brand. And I think it took some of the retailers a while to realise that.
And I think some of them haven't still realised that. In some respect, they talk much about values and talk about brand values, but they don't necessarily honour it. And I think it's just a problem within business generally, whereby the focus is upon revenue generation. It's about bottom line profit.
It's very understandable that in the modern world, and it's, I think it's always been the case, if you're in business, if you're not making a profit, then you're not going to be in business for very long. So it's perfectly legitimate, I think, for companies to have a very sharp eye on the bottom line. However, if your business requires people to come to you, then you need to think, every business needs to think about the total experience. It's a bit like if a theatre has a car park. Forget, you know, retail for a moment. If you go to a show, the last thing you want to find when you come out of the show is that you've attracted a parking charge notice. It really would take the shine off the event for you.
It would, most definitely.
And I think that if you were running a theatre, you would need to think, how long are people going to need to be here for the particular show in question? Is it easy for them to, if I'm going to charge for parking, for example, is it easy to do that? One of the areas I think that really does need a rethink, I know the government, our new government, has said something about this, is hospitals. I haven't ever said that I think every hospital car park should be free. Frankly, I think some hospitals have such limited car parking that you just do need a way of managing it. You do need a way of trying to encourage people, come do whatever you have to do and go. And indeed, for goodness sake, don't use a town or city centre hospital car park and not go to the hospital, but do it because it's in a convenient place. But by the same token, I had to take a family member to hospital yesterday. I pulled into the park. I walked to the nearest pay and display machine, which was out of order. I walked to the next nearest one, which was out of order.
Hopefully it wasn't one that we managed.
And I'm going to mention no names. Okay. I'm not going to tell you the hospital. I'm not going to tell you the operator. But I finally got to the third machine, which was the far side of the car park. I happily had my credit card because although it would have accepted coins, it wasn't going to accept coins today. And when I got to that machine, there was a lady waiting, a lady was there in front of me who only had coins. And she begged me, and I did. I paid for her, and she gave me the coins. Every step of that journey was a bit more stressful for a journey that was already stressful enough because I got my family member in the car, and they're thinking, we've got to get into the hospital for my appointment. And then, again, this might astonish you, the NHS was running a bit late. A wonderful organisation, but they were running a bit late. And so instead of sitting, paying close attention to what we were hearing and not worrying, I was forever looking at my watch because I thought any second now I'm going to have to run back outside quite a long way and feed the machine again and pay for another ticket because I thought we'd be done within a certain amount of time and we weren't. And all of that just makes the hospital visit even more stressful, and most of us find hospital visits stressful enough already.
And so what's your view on pay on exit technology? Do you feel that it resolves that issue?
Hugely. Mm-hmm. Hugely. I don't think any technology is necessarily a silver bullet that solves everything. Mm-hmm. But I think if I compare that experience I've told you about with another recent experience, or actually going to a show in the evening, we didn't have to think about it. We didn't have to look at our watches. We didn't have to rush back to the vehicle because we knew we'd get back to the vehicle.
And
we'd
pay, peace of mind.
Yeah, we'd pay what it needed to be. And it just takes a bit of the hassle away.
And so do you feel that pay on exit is something that should be looked to encourage throughout all NHS trusts and sites?
Yes. Yeah, I think.
Pretty much like the standard technology for a hospital.
Yes, I would say that. And I would say also, I mean, it's quite understandable. If you're running a hospital, perhaps it's slightly more understandable that you're not thinking about parking in the way I've just said that a retailer should, because the retailer wants you to come and knows you could go somewhere else. The hospital's got more people turning up than it knows what to do with. So it's a different issue. Nevertheless, because of the issues facing the people who are turning up, I think that making the parking experience is easy for them, and indeed access by other modes of transport too. Let's not forget that. But for those of us who do need to use their car to get to the hospital, I think pay on exit is by far the preferable solution.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that the public and private sector could learn from each other?
Yes, I think one of the things that I suspect will be coming to the private sector shortly is the single independent appeals body. I think the mechanism by which I could appeal against a penalty charge notice is clear, straightforward, and wholly independent of the individual local authorities.
And so do you think the private sector, the fact that there's two independent appeal bodies, do you think that causes some confusion to motorists?
I think that, well, I'll probably take you back to what I said earlier on. I suspect most motorists have absolutely no idea that there are accredited trade associations at all.
You're probably right, actually. Yeah.
I suspect they have no idea, for most of the car parks they go into, that they're independently managed by subcontractors rather than by the business that they're stopping at. So what they really want is, ideally, they don't want to receive a parking charge notice at all. But if they do get one, they want to know how easily they can challenge it and whether they're sending it to someone who has no incentive to find against them. Now, I'm not saying that either of the appeal services that run, that the adjudicators feel that. But if I think in particular, perhaps about the penalty, the appeals service that the IPC runs, it is rather behind closed doors. We don't really know who's hearing the appeals. We don't really know what basis they're making their mind up. And I think that having a single separate body appointed by government that is has one job and one job only, and that's to come to the right decisions and not get any particular benefit either way, it would be a good way to go. I suspect there are other things, perhaps about the use of technology, that go the other way, where the public sector could learn from some of the better private practice. I would say, even though all of the signs relating to parking, signs, road markings that relate to parking on the highway, are all tightly prescribed in the signs manual, which the Transport Department publishes. So even down to the font and the size of the letters, it's all set out. But they're not always brilliantly displayed. It's not always completely obvious to see. Sometimes the line markings aren't as good as they should be. Mm-hmm. Whereas I can think of instances where on a private park's very, very clear, a sign says, for example, in the car park for the building where we're sitting now, there's a great big sign right at the front of the gateway that says, this is private land. So don't confuse us with the public car park next door. This is private land. And if you're not entitled to be here, don't be here. So there can be no doubt about it. What I think we really need is for the obligations for the contract, as we think of it, between the landowner, the landowner's agent, and the member of the public to be as clear as possible.
And you mentioned in relation to that IPC and the independent appeals body and about it being behind closed doors. Do you feel there has to be greater transparency in relation to audits? And would there be benefits to the public if that was made public information?
I think that transparency is one of the key ways of building trust.
I agree.
So I think that the transparency of process is something that we put on a pedestal in most other aspects of our legal system. And transparency is a good thing. So I would like to understand who is making the decision. I'd like to understand the criteria they've applied. And if at its extreme, this might be going a bit far for some tastes, but if a case is taken to court or a case is taken to judicial review, the judge will write up, here is my decision and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would help people to understand, not just I've heard your appeal and I am approving or not agreeing to your appeal. Here's why.
I think it's, you know, we've very much been an advocate for greater transparency, especially when it comes to compliance and the audits that are administered by the accrediting bodies. And we've always felt that competition in the long run will breed excellence and raise people's games. So do you think that the industries would benefit from some form of a league table demonstrating how well or how successful operators have been in regards to their annual audits by the accrediting bodies?
I think it's an interesting idea, and I can see how that would potentially help. After all, we publish the parking income of every local authority, and we don't publish it as a league table, but undoubtedly that's how people view it, who's mm-hmm. raking in the most cash and who's collecting less. What I would say is what we need to do is get to a clearer basic standard. So at the moment, there are two codes of practice. The foundation has long said, why don't we just have one? Why don't we have one that covers all eventualities? And that basic standard should be something which is met. So I think when we're talking about auditing companies and having perhaps a league table, I'd be more interested in how much better than the basic level is an operator achieving rather than are they complying or not? Because if they're not complying, I don't think we should be releasing the DVLA data. And I think that's really government's only stick here.
Mm-hmm.
It can make it easier or harder to get hold of the vehicle keeper data. I think that we also need to remember that, again, this may sound a completely daft thing to say, but parking facilities are where they are. They're geographically specific. Whereas I can choose from where I live to go one direction to Sainsbury's and another direction to Tesco's or to another retailer. If I want to go to a particular place, I'm going to choose the car park that's convenient for that particular place. And it's potluck for me, the consumer, who's actually managing that car park. So competition at that level is more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
If the landowners, and again, I'm particularly thinking here about landowners who want me to come to their facility. If they regard parking as part of the overall experience of being one of their customers, they might then be interested in a league table of which are the best companies to employ to look after their car parks and to be part of the shop window to their customers.
I totally agree. And so from a motorist viewpoint, what are the main issues that motorists raise with you?
The main issues, the ones that come through time and again, are people not understanding, not really having seen what rules that apply to them. So signs not being terribly visible, terribly clear, written in language that they readily understand. If I think for a moment of the difference between the sign in a fairly standard private car park and out on the street, it's pretty clear cut. There's a yellow line here and there's a plaque up on a pole that says these are the hours when you can't park here. If I think of the sign that's up in the car park at the end of this street, it's quite a lot of words.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a hurry, I think the people who are parking there are probably nipping into the shops or something.
Mm.
They don't want to be standing there for 5 minutes or 10 minutes reading all of these rules.
Yeah.
So
overkill.
There's an issue there. I think there are some other issues that tend to be the, I'm not saying that they happen all the time, but instances where people have driven into a car park, not found somewhere and driven out again. The AMPRs pick them up coming in, but perhaps not pick them up going out. And so the operator thinks they've been in there and they haven't. And I think when you're in a system that is heavily automated, as the ANPR systems are, you can just feel like a tiny cog in the machine that rather than perhaps in days of old, there was a person there, mm-hmm. somebody who you could speak to, you've done something, a camera has clicked and a letter has issued. And lastly, I guess, and the letter that's issued looks surprisingly like it's been issued as a legal threat. So it's not saying, valued customer, I think you might have made a mistake here. Please can I check if you did overstay, this is the amount of money you owe me, but good news, I'm not going to charge you the full amount and we can part friends. It's rather more designed to look like a penalty charge, and it's designed to get people to react in a particular way, which is, oh dear, I have no choice, I better pay up.
And so do you feel that the industry itself has benefited from the incorporation of the IPC?
I find it hard to say having two trade associations is a benefit. I mean, lots of professions have more than one professional body. I'm a member of two professional institutions, the CIHT and the CILT. So they cover subtly different things, but a lot of what they do is similar. So I have no particular problem with there being more than one trade association. I'm not sure that having more than one of itself has done a great deal to improve the sector or improve the ability of parking operators to perform.
And sort of what do you think can be done more to educate general public on parking matters? Obviously, we've got the BPA, the IPC, and then you've got the public sector. So you've got sort of almost three strands all about parking. And how does Joe Public find out the difference between a penalty charge and a parking charge? Because they are two different, albeit similar, things. And I've got friends that haven't got a clue, and they've only learned because I'm in the industry. But if I wasn't, I wouldn't have a clue what the difference was. And you see on social media, I'll ignore a parking charge, you can just throw it in the bin, it's an invoice. But as we've found out, that's very not true when sort of people get CCJs.
Yes, I think that advising anyone, if they receive an invoice or a penalty charge notice, to throw it away. In my experience, problems rarely go away just because you don't think about them. They generally need you to think about them and do something. So I would always advise people to do something. But if I go back to the protection of freedoms and the regulations made at the time, I have to ask, why on earth did we call parking charge notices that name? Why do we call them PCNs? Was it to make people think this is so similar to a penalty charge notice with which you are familiar that it's a good idea to use the same acronym? Or if I was of a nasty, suspicious mind, which obviously I'm not, I might think it was an attempt to make them the exact opposite, to look like they were a penalty charge notice and to make you think, oh, this is a penalty charge that's been issued by the government, I'd better pay up and not ask questions. But I come back to your question about educating. I think we should think a bit less about educating people, because there's a sense there that we need to get people to learn stuff. But actually, what we need is to make using the system as intuitive as it can possibly be, so that people understand what's expected of them, and that way many more of them are going to comply. It's the same in practically every aspect of motoring. If people can see why the speed limit is what it is for a particular stretch of road, if it feels about right, chances are they're going to stick to it. If, on the other hand, it feels like a very low limit on a very wide road, it shouldn't surprise us that some of them think, well, I'll go at the speed that I think is safe, not the speed that has been set. So the whole business needs to think of the consumer experience, as I say very often, viewed through the windscreen. If you were using this service as a customer, would it be clear to you? Would it be clear how long you can stay here if there's a free period for someone going to a shop? Would it be clear how much you have to pay if it's a pay and display car park? Are the rules on where you should put your car absolutely clear? Are the markings clear? And like I say, in many designed, purpose-designed car parks, all of that is fine. And I recognise that even at 8 million, that's a fraction of the number of times in a year that people actually park a car. The trouble is, with everything relating to motoring, we've got 38 million people with driving licences. We've got over 30 million cars. A fraction of that number is still a big number, and it still should cause us to pause and think, how on earth can it be that over 8 million times a year people need to get the keeper details out of the DVLA? It just makes me think something here is going wrong. And could we make that number smaller? Could we make the experience better by doing better on the very basics, which are about signs that are easy to see, really easy to understand, that don't look like all of the small print at the bottom of a contract? That would be where I'd start.
And so do you think that the consumer or the motorist is actually ready for the technical changes that have occurred? For example, going cashless. A number of local authorities have moved to totally cashless systems now. Do you think the democracy is yet ready, or the world as a whole, are we ready for it?
I think it's a worry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a worry for the story I was telling earlier, that the lady in front of me at the machine was standing there staring at the machine, holding her pound coins in her hand, and she really didn't know what to do. That would be a very good example, actually. She didn't know what to do, and there was no indication of what on earth she could do. So in that instance, out of five machines, two or three weren't working properly. Two weren't working at all, and the one she was trying to use wasn't accepting coins. If that's going to happen, then surely there should have been something there saying, if you haven't got a card, here's what you do. Because there are some people who still don't have credit cards, who still don't have bank cards, and who still don't have smartphones. Now, I accept that
it's
many
changing.
Of us do.
We're in
many
a transition
of us
period.
My 92-year-old mum had a mobile phone and a laptop and used email.
Mm-hmm.
But we still need to make it possible for those folks who haven't moved into that world to go about their business. And if we're going into a cashless approach, mm-hmm. there needs to be an avenue for them, which could be issuing them with a separate card of some sort, I'm thinking. If you think, for example, the Oyster card. You don't have to have an Oyster card to travel on the tube. You can just put your credit card or your bank card on the reader. But some of us choose to have the specific card for that purpose. So maybe a local authority mm-hmm. going into a cashless approach needs to have some sort of dedicated card that people who haven't got that facility can use.
Because, you know, from our experience, we have clients that push us, they want to move to a totally cashless system, but yet we just don't feel that the general public are yet ready for it. In a utopian world, yeah, amazing. It serves a purpose and it just makes things so more efficient. But I think the reality of things yet, we're not yet there.
I spent most of my working life in central London mm-hmm. and in government departments. And I guess practically everyone around me would be very used, certainly these days, very used to paying even for their sandwich at lunch with a contactless card. And that's what they're used to doing. And it's so easy to become detached in that world from another world that's not that far away, where in a lot of households, the money for travel, the money for parking, it's in a jam jar and it's cash. And that's how the people operate. Not everyone operates in the smartphone, credit card enabled world. And I think we need to have a mind to the fact that these people, we don't want to deny them access to our town centres, for heaven's sake. We need to make it possible for them to do that. Now, whether there are better technological answers to that, I'm not sure.
You are listening to Break the Mould, the parking podcast with Alistair Finlayson and Ryan Jackson.
Because I think that's kind of the problem with technology as a whole, is that it's changing people's behaviour.
So I would say two things about that. One is, I think I absolutely agree with you that it takes a long time for everybody to change. So you will hear people say loosely that everyone's got a smartphone. Well, no, just most people have got a smartphone. Most people have got a credit card, but not everyone. But I wonder, just thinking laterally about it as you raise the issue, whether something akin to the way that hotels operate these days, where they will ask you to pay a deposit using your card when you book into the room in case you want to use the minibar or any some of the other services. And then as you check out, they'll take out of that deposit such money as you've spent and return the rest. So maybe we could still have a pay on exit, but you pay a deposit or you register that you've come in. And that way you register with your card if it's a cashless system. And then you register when you are leaving, and it's at that point that the calculation is made and the sum is deducted.
And there is a system on the market which does exactly that. And obviously, if you forget to check out, so to speak, it just takes the whole deposit because it assumes you've stayed for the maximum duration. But then, again, going back to what Ryan said earlier, with people being so used to paying on arrival, going to pay on exit, people forgetting, it's another step in the journey where people forget. So, for example, in a hotel scenario, that's fantastic because you have to go to reception to collect your room key and to return it. But in a car park, you might not necessarily be, depending on the layout, of course, but, you know, going to the machine might not always be on your natural route back to your vehicle.
I so absolutely recognise that.
It's a great idea in
it's
concept,
a minefield, really.
Everything is a minefield, isn't it?
You come up with, I think I would certainly acknowledge, and I would certainly say to anyone, when we're talking about the business of managing private parking, we need to get clear in our minds right from the outset that we're talking about many different forms of business. We're talking about different buildings. There's a world of difference between a multi-story car park built for that purpose, which has all of the relevant machinery, and you have to go through a gateway to get in, and you have to go through a gateway to get out. And that's quite different from a relatively scrubby piece of wasteland that somebody is using as a car park for the time being because they haven't got planning permission to build on it yet or something like that. But, you know, that's the sort of spectrum that we're talking about. And different approaches will be right for those different places. But in any instance where we're getting people to change from ingrained behavior, from a world that they're very used to, well, it's incumbent on us to help them understand that. Something has got to feel different. Otherwise, I'm as likely to make the mistake as everyone else.
And so really the key is clear instructions. If you get to the bottom, if you think about it, the key to a successful parking experience, whether that be a customer in Sainsbury's, like you said earlier, or the sort of power and exit, or the sort of check-in, check-out system, it all boils down to sort of clear signage and clear instructions. So like you said with Sainsbury's, your number plate came up on the screen. It said when you have to leave. Nothing is left to the imagination. And I feel that's where both private and public sector could learn a lot from in terms of the clear instructions, how to use the machine. How does the car park operate? Do you pay when you arrive? Do you pay when you leave? Have you got the option to pay when you get home online? So I think instructions and clear signage is key.
And I think we have to look beyond signage, because just the general person, we're talking about behaviours. When they enter the car park, generally, they don't necessarily look at the signage. And I myself have been a victim, and I use the word loosely, but no, I have been a victim of receiving a parking charge now as a result of pay and exit, just because I totally forget to pay as I'm leaving. So, you know, and if anything, I shouldn't be forgetting. So it is, you know.
This is a very brave admission.
No, I own it.
Live broadcast.
But no, and this is the thing. So I think we need to be looking at outside of what we're already doing and be very innovative in nature, looking at other features we could potentially introduce into the car park, or if we're utilizing technology to really help or to ensure that motorists aren't being penalised incorrectly. And it's something definitely we've been looking into. But I think the industry as a whole, we have to have that progressive outlook and be more open-minded and not necessarily look at what we've always done and look outside and sometimes look to new industries. What are other industries doing? Are there aspects of their features or their technology that we can look to introduce to make ours better?
I absolutely agree. I think that we have to recognise that the world has moved on, that technology has produced a wider range of options. Mm-hmm. As I was saying, for example, the system in a supermarket that automatically reads your number plate and plays it back to you. Some of these come at a cost. Clearly, nothing in this life is free. And if you're trying to run a business and bear down on costs, I can see why people don't want to over-egg it and don't want to invest in technology that racks up the cost to them. Happily, the cost of technology does tend to fall quite rapidly once you get to a mass market.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think everyone needs to bear in mind that at the end of the day, we are human and we are inclined to make mistakes sometimes. I walk past a supermarket on my way to your office here. There are large signs up in the car park reminding people to take their shopping bag into the shop. And I suspect that's because, like me, a lot of people put their shopping bags in the car and then they get into the shop and then they start shopping and then they realise they've got to buy another bag because they've left their bags out in the car.
That certainly resonates with me.
Now, you could look at that and you could say, well, surely it works in the supermarket's favour because that way you've got to buy another bag. But no, because what they understand is they'd far rather that I didn't leave with a sour taste in my mouth of having to buy another bag, that I actually bought the things I wanted and with a bit of luck in the supermarket's way, a couple of other things as well, not something that I didn't really want because I had it already. And I think that same mindset needs to apply here, that you want people to park and leave and at best think they had a good experience. And at minimum, many years ago, I worked with the guys at London Underground. And the ambition of the managing director of London Underground was that a trip on the tube should be as exciting as a trip in a lift. You should just press a button like a lift. The lift comes, you get on, you get off at your floor, you don't think about it. It just happens, and it all happens when you're expecting it to, and it all happens safely and smoothly. And that's what he was going for. And I suspect trying to make parking a pleasurable experience is always going to be a challenge, well, take you right back to your earlier comments about the joys of trying to parallel park in the street. At least we could reduce it to the level where it isn't unpleasant. It just happens. It's a routine part of making the trip and you don't really have to think about it. That's what I think we should aim for.
And do you think, obviously, we spoke a lot about retail, and do you feel that retailers could be doing more to assist the parking operators? You mentioned that technology isn't cheap. And we'll go back to the example of the AMPR with the number plate on the screen. That's going to be quite an expensive system. And so obviously the retailer is in their interest to protect their brand, to protect their reputation, and to have you return because you left the, you left having a pleasant parking experience and shopping experience. So do you feel that there should be a little bit of emphasis on the retailers to think about that in a more granular level? Because these technologies aren't cheap, and they often expect the parking operators to pay for everything. And then that leaves the parking operator with nowhere to go other than to recoup their costs through parking charge notices
and start adopting stricter policies.
And then it comes down to a vicious cycle of penalising genuine customers to recoup the costs when you're delivering a better experience for them. And that's what the operator's goal should be.
I think that really this all comes back to what I'll call the landowner's responsibility. That if I were a landowner and I wanted you to visit my shop, my theatre, my facility, it's incumbent on me to think about the experience from your perspective. And if I want you to come back again, I need to make that experience as good as it can be. And I think historically, many landowners regarded managing the car park as a mechanical exercise that they didn't need to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And in some places, I think that's probably true. If the car park isn't a particularly heavily used one, not necessarily in the centre of town, not that much call for a lot of attention, where I would say it's quite different. The circumstance I was describing at my own local supermarkets, they have the blessing and the curse of being really rather close to the railway station. So it would be quite tempting for some people to think, well, I won't go into the station car park, I'll park in the supermarket and no one will notice. And that's going to get in the way of people coming to the supermarket to buy goods. So I can see they need to think about the location, they need to think about the sort of people who are coming to their facility, and they need to think, how can we make this work for them?
Steve, thank you very much for coming onto the show. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for inviting me, and I wish you every success.
And that's it for the very first episode of Break the Mold, the parking podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening just as much as we enjoyed recording. If you did, follow the channel, write a review, tell a friend, tell a colleague, pass the pod. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another special guest. So until then, thank you for listening as we break the mold.